Hey, what's going on? This is the Educated Guest Podcast, and I'm Justin, your host. Hey, if this is your very first time listening, I just want to say thank you for joining, and thank you for being a part of something larger than yourself. So what is this thing? What is Educated Guest? Well, Educated Guest is a virtual art school dedicated to multidisciplinary designers and artists, people who don't necessarily fit into one category. And we believe that pedagogy, I think that's the word of the month, if you've been following along, still trying to figure out what that means. And our moniker, our tagline is still learning, for the reason that exists within all of us, which is to say that we're all still seeking and learning to find peace in the seeking. So what does our learning method look like? We find it to come in three forms, and we break this sort of delivery of our message down into three segments, the first of which is called Incomplete Thoughts. It comes on Mondays, and it's dedicated to the development of the mind. We're looking to ask questions around routine, around habit, around, you know, mental toughness, all the things that you would typically associate with like an athlete or, you know, a high performer. But we are high performers in art. So then our second segment is called Work Study. This is dedicated to those who are actually practicing, you know, and looking for nuanced, detailed breakdowns or templates or how-tos to get them from, you know, point C to point D. Maybe you're already past point A and B, but you're looking for that next step. And then on Fridays, we have what's called Well Read. That's what you're listening to today. Well Read is dedicated to delivering a portraiture of sorts, or a still life of an artist that we're studying at this particular time. And mostly we're interested in uncovering like these underpinnings that drive their particular body of work. You know, some questions that we're seeking to answer in this are mostly around sort of the biographical and then the psychoanalytic analysis around a particular artist. Some of these conversations are indeed conversations. We talk directly with the artist, and some of them are just monologues where you're here directly from me. And as the music fades out, I'm sure you're guessing, and you've guessed correctly, that this is one of those monologues where you're going to hear from me. And before we get into this detailed story today, I want to invite you into our membership by just simply asking you to go to educated-guest.com and subscribe to our email newsletter, and we'll explain more about what's up next and sort of all the different things we have going on and how to become part of the community. Also, you can follow us at educated_guests on the gram. All right, so that said, I mentioned questions we're looking to answer via this segment. We're particularly interested in Jackson Pollock today. And the first question is, how do you know when you're finished making love? The second question is, you know, is this a painting? And those are two oddball questions to start with, namely out of, you know, more humor than anything, because they're actually pulled from the film that sort of depicts and chronicles the life of Jackson Pollock called Pollock. So one great way of summarizing Jackson Pollock's sort of polarity and the reason we're interested in him today is for that very reason. That word of polarity is one of great interest to what we're doing right now and learning what it means to operate somewhere within two polar opposites and not being afraid to challenge the status quo so that you can sort of push the entire practice of your, you know, of your artwork forward. Now, I promise this isn't going to be me rambling forever and ever. Amen. There's structure. There's method to the madness. And there's three particular things that we want to cover today. The first is going to be developing a clear understanding of Jackson Pollock's inspiration. A lot of times people start with, you know, sort of, oh, well, where were they born? And, you know, what did they do? Who did they marry? And what were their most famous works? We're going to get into some of that. But first, I want to start with the inspiration. And the second one is I want to walk through how to sort of interpret the work itself. You know, when you're looking at it, when you're looking at a typical Pollock painting, and for those who are even more knowledgeable about studying and reading artwork, particularly visual art and painting, then, you know, you probably know more than I do. But that's the purpose of sort of this egalitarian form of teaching, is that we're all learning as we go forward. So maybe there's something new that I can talk about in terms of interpreting the work itself. And then the third thing I'll cover is contextualizing the work in history. I think this is very important, particularly as we sort of move into a new generation where we're learning that certain events, cultural events, you know, systemic events, world events, actually do impact the psyche of an entire generation. And some people push and some people pull, and people are gnawing at this sort of, you know, endless, you know, dog bone, if you will, of life. And they're trying to figure out what to do with it. So we're going to talk some about the contextual moments in history that were contemporary to Jackson Pollock's work. All right. So the interesting place to start, as most stories, is at the very beginning. And I just want to pay particular, you know, a couple notes to where he was born. He's born in Cody, Wyoming. Now, I find that really interesting. Just not many people even know about Cody, Wyoming, aside from maybe Jackson Pollock and now Kanye West living there. So he was born in 1912, immediately being thrust into a set of world circumstances that were quite frankly instrumental in defining an entire generation, like I just mentioned. So let's note a couple of those. So most notably, you know, he was coming of age during a time of Jim Crow in the 20s, you know, the teens in the 20s of the 20th century, World War I, World War II, and the Great Depression. Not in that order, obviously, but these are the four primary world events at the time. I mean, obviously, there's the Roaring 20s, where you're at, you know, there's plenty and plenty of, you know, splendor and abundance for the entire U.S. population for the most part. But Jim Crow is also going on in parallel with that. So highlighting these four particular moments, and we'll come back to them soon, and we'll talk about their contextual importance a little bit later. All right. So let's talk about his art education. So he was actually, surprisingly, despite, you know, some people thinking that his work is just the work of a madman, he received a rather traditional art education. And it was at, you know, this place called Manual Arts High School in Los Angeles, and later at the Art Students League in New York. And eventually he kind of strayed from this conventional approach to art and started working on his own unique forms of artistic expression. And this was sort of the breaking of the norm. And in this sort of breaking of the norm, he found a particular interest in Native American art and culture, which is really interesting because in the 40s, just to fast forward in his story, he found, this is mostly noted by, you know, most art critics and historians, where he went to this demonstration at the MoMA in New York, and it was a Navajo Native American sand painting demonstration sometime in the 40s. And in this time, he sort of noted this moment as a point of inspirational underpinning for the development of his famous dripping method. And, you know, if you go and you look at photos of stills of this Navajo Native American sand painting method, you start to see the immediate connecting points. And the reason why I wanted to start with this inspiration as our, like, first, you know, filter through of, you know, first lens of analyzing sort of Pollock's life is because I think it tells a lot about the humanity of a person. We begin to put artists on a pedestal to the point where we think that they are never inspired by anything other than themselves. Yet when we start to see the interconnectedness of past work to current work to future work, you begin to understand the continuum that we're all a part of. So this dripping method, as most know, consisted of pouring, flinging, dripping paint, basically throwing stuff all over the place, seemingly, onto a canvas on the ground while simultaneously circling the piece in a dance-like movement. So it was this first, you know, foray into painting as performance art. You know, the dance was never complete until the painting had revealed itself to Jackson. And it's very interesting that he wasn't the very first to even, you know, publicly try what is called the dripping method. Like, this is, it's more on a continuum than a definitive point in which he began this. So it's worth noting some other artists that he was particularly inspired by and, you know, began sort of this movement of abstract expressionism. And some other ones that I've noted down are just Hans Hofmann, Lee Krasner, Roberto Mata, Andrew Masson, and the list just goes on and on and on. So by describing his abstraction as an attempt to, quote, evoke the rhythmic energy of nature, Pollock's early work paid obvious homage to Picasso, Miro, David Alfaro Siqueiros, and Jose Clemente Orozco. So these are, that's the end of the quote. So these are very important contemporaries to note, and even like people who predate sort of Pollock's work. And I think by starting there and laying that foundation of understanding who his inspirations were, you're able to read the work a lot better and a lot more clearly in context to everything else that was going on. Because, you know, nostalgia is a great drug. We all want, and there's a quote here that's like, most people like the idea of liking and admiring Pollock's paintings more than they admire and understand the paintings themselves. And I find that to be a really interesting note, because as we move into this second segment, so that completes the first filter. Now, if we look at the second filter through which we can kind of see Pollock's work, it's this filter of interpretation. You know, what does the work mean? What are you supposed to do with it? How do you interpret it? How do you read it? And it's very interesting that Pollock notes that, you know, he doesn't encourage that you look for anything. Most works, you look for something. It's almost a scavenger hunt for the end. And he instead compared it much to, you know, the interpretation of music. You know, you don't look for anything in music. You're not looking for any particular note to be played at a certain time. You do look for conflict and resolution and completion, and there are musical, you know, methods to bring those about, to bring tension about. You know, you have crescendos to bring, you know, particular attention to a moment, but the moment is still fleeting, and he really wanted people to view his work in that similar way. So there's a quote from him that says, "Today painters do not have to go to a subject matter outside of themselves. They work from a different source. They work from within." So you start to see this, and we'll get into historical context in our third and final filter, but you start to see this continuity between between different generations. It's almost like a bridge between generations that he was. That's why, you know, media sort of viewed him as the chosen one to take you from one form of painting, and I'll get into that in just a second, to a completely different one. And Clement Greenberg, I don't know if it's Clement or Clement, I'm not sure. But I don't think he's French. He's definitely American, so it's probably Clement. But he's probably the single most influential art critic in the 20th century. And in the 1950s, he described Pollock's work as, quote, the dissolution of the pictorial into pure sensation. And that's the end of the quote. It's very interesting to like see things this way, because next thing you know, you start realizing, wait a minute, that's how people sort of do things now. You know, everything is grunge. Everything is punk. Everything is, hip hop. You know, hip hop, everything's rock and roll. Why? Because, you know, everything's jazz. Why? Why did these things catch on? You know, why were these across different mediums? What is it about interpretation and improvisation? I don't know why I just said it like that. Improvisation. What is it about these moments that have catapulted these different forms of expression into mainstream? And I believe, and we're going to get into some of that around the historical context around the work. We'll get into that next. So it makes a lot of sense when attempting to read the work as the narrative, you know, content begins to disappear and the image becomes more felt than seen. That's what jazz is all about. It's not about, oh, did they hit all the notes right? It's, you know, were they playing the music or were they just playing the notes? So during this time, you know, Pollock actually began to number his paintings. And it's very interesting that he would choose to do something like that, where they're more like musical compositions and, you know, his, instead of just moments in time, you know, he's starting to view these things as moments in a whole collection, as opposed to just any one particular thing that you should capture is like the Mona Lisa. And it's important to mention again, his sort of method of making the work. Why? Because most people don't think that he's purposeful in his work. And same thing goes for, like, you know, Basquiat. I think Basquiat's a great example where it looks like his work is purposeless. But if you study any and you read about him, you realize his stroke of the brush was extremely purposeful and extremely exact in the way that he was doing things. So it just shows the brilliance of understanding classical art and the way that, you know, the way you can use shadow, the way you can use color, the way you can use contrast, the way you can use these different artistic elements to actually express an idea, but then you can break that so much, like break it so much that it's still beautiful. That's what makes hip hop cool. That's what makes grunge cool. That's what makes someone like Jimi Hendrix cool. It's like the fact that you can play a guitar upside down, because you don't want to play it right side up. You don't want to like conform to that. Like, what in the world? And you still make such beautiful music. I think of, you know, his Star Spangled Banner at Woodstock, I believe, where I think if you're interested, I think it's on Spotify. Just go listen to that and just hear, you know, how unique it sounds, but how reverent it is still to the original, because you have such knowledge of both. You're able to break it in a way that's still beautiful. So let's step back for a second in learning to interpret Pollock's work to a place where you can start to see the continuity between mediums, between artists, between a generation, and what was being felt about that generation. All right, cool. So that's the second filter. The second filter is about interpretation. So what are you supposed to do with the work? How do you look at it? It's very interesting. The last note on this is that a couple of quotes stood out to me is this idea of energy and motion being made visible. You know, memories arrested in space is how people talk about this. And it's really clear that humanity was here. And I think that's, out of everything that I've read, that's the most important takeaway from Pollock's work to me, is that, you know, still lives and capturing humanity in an ideal state seems to be not enough to really capture the fullness of life and the fullness of pain and the range of emotion that everyone felt during these moments of, as I mentioned before, four critical and unimaginably impactful cultural events and world events during the time. So you're at a point now where you've begun to react in a way by capturing what cannot be captured in reality. So lastly, as I mentioned before, this is to wrap things up. The third and final filter that I want to look at is historical context and the relevance therein. I mentioned earlier this idea of still lifes and portraits being insufficient. And the reason they're insufficient is because you take an idea like, I'm going to go for a stretch here. Let's take an idea like World War II. And there's a couple of different images, three or four. I want you to close your eyes and just imagine those four or five images that come to mind when you think of World War II. And most of us were not, I don't even know if there are any still living veterans of World War II. And most of us don't know anyone that fought in World War II or was alive during it. Pretty sure they were alive during it, but fought in it is very rare. So when we're thinking about that, we have to think about the fact that there are prime and perfect and prim and proper images, and then there are images that evoke a bit darker sense of what the war was like. So in considering these polar opposite images, one might immediately notice that there's a huge gap in between of all the nuanced emotions that are felt by the people themselves. You know, And at this time, you can only imagine the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. There's an extreme amount of judgment, if you will, around dealings with mental health. There's an extreme amount of judgment around dealings with, you know, unconventional ideas. I mean, we're still, historically speaking, at least 10, 20, 30 years away from sort of the sexual revolution and the peace movements of the 60s and 70s. So contextually speaking, this was more of a, this was an important time in American history in particular. I know there's a lot more parties involved in World War II and World War I than just Americans, but this was particularly interesting because it marked a time in which, you know, a post-war America could finally thrive. And obviously there's still, you know, who was it thriving for? These questions around, you know, discrimination. There's these questions around injustice that are also going in parallel at the time in the 40s and 50s. Yet, if you were to zoom out from a broader perspective and see sort of the 10 to the 15th power view of things, you're starting to see that, wait a minute, in the art world, Pollock sort of represented this crossing of the chasm between traditional and the non-traditional, between the clear and realistic versions of depicted life and the unclear, and sort of the idiosyncrasy, sort of this like unimaginable understanding and all this like I can't figure this out feeling, this inscrutability of the work that is just there and is always there. So I find it very interesting that his work becomes a little bit more interpretive in the practice and not as focused on trying to articulate one singular point, which I think is very, when you just kind of think about how your subconscious or even just like your mind works and sort of how dreams work. And if you imagine Pollock's paintings, it's more of like a dream than real life well lived, if you will, or true documents. Then you start to realize that really it's just these small little pictures that are almost operating like stained glass windows, and they patch together perfectly to give you a certain image, and then all the glass falls down. And it's very interesting that you're taken on this journey when you view a piece of his work, and you're starting to see that there's this ability to be dazzled by what we experience every day, sort of like that subconscious experience every single day, and not really be worried about, you know, these 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different cultural markers or life markers that inevitably we will have. It's almost the beauty found in the nuance, the beauty found within and made personal and made public via this medium. And I know all of this sounds maybe very very bombastic. I think that's the word I want to use. What I'm saying is, sounds like I'm blowing it out of proportion, being hyperbolic, all these big words, just to say that, you know, his work was excellent. You know, his work was excellent in the fact that it definitely showed a clear understanding of classical technique while being able to break it in a way that was unique to, you know, express his inner beings and inner demons, or inner angels, if you will. I don't know why we always call inner demons, you know, why can't they be angels too? So the last thing I want to say as we wrap up is just when you're going and you're studying these artists, I'm not highlighting artists for the purpose of you emulating and mimicking them, or even being discouraged like, oh, someone's already done that. I'm highlighting in this particular way because it shows a continuum of expression that's needed from generation to generation to generation. You know, just because some might say there's only going to be and ever will be one Kurt Cobain, one Basquiat, you know, these cultural markers that for this particular community, I would argue are particularly interesting for everybody here, because of their ability to rage against whatever the establishment is. And this rage obviously is worth being emulated because you feel something within. But what's beautiful about Pollock's work is that he's able to sort of express his inner self without even looking outside to mimic someone else's way of experiencing it. And that's what's beautiful about, I'll close with this, what's beautiful about is the dripping method is that he's showing an ability to release sort of the control of these, of the inner workings. And if you think about that both through a psychoanalytic lens and also from a biographical lens, or even just through a historical lens of like what this means, you know, you can get super deep or you can be very shallow. It's like, oh, well, you could be, call it laziness. It's like, oh, well, when you remove control, you can't ever say that it was bad or good or anything, because it wasn't really you. But at the same time, when you remove control, it's more representative of how we actually work through our own thoughts and subconscious. And when you conquer them, if they ever are conquered or if they ever are understood, it's usually from a place of acceptance. It's usually from a place of surrender. And if you look at any religious or any spiritual or any cult or any large group of believers in a singular idea, it's usually around this sense of surrender. Everyone's seeking to surrender. And if you can surrender to what's within, then you have conquered. So at that point, I believe Pollock's work is really representative of this surrendering to the realities and allowing the space within, the space and the distance between his brush and the canvas to dictate what is true and what is expressed. And it's almost like we operate within that space every single day. And this removal of authorship shows the this ability for everyone to be invited to connect to this experience, which I think is really, really pertinent for, and really particularly the catalyst for everybody's attraction to Pollock's work. Cause it's like, oh, I could have done this. I see some of me in this somehow, but I don't know how. It's like trying to remember a dream 5 minutes after you wake up. It's always hard. So that's all I had for today. Hopefully this has been helpful and informative and inspirational for you. Again, if you're interested in following along, if you have questions just about why we're doing this, what we're seeking, or if you have some comments or, you know, just discussion points, feel free to reach out at educated_guests on Instagram, and we'll be sure to get back to you there. And I'm looking forward to what's next. We'll talk soon. Peace.